All right, good morning, everyone. Thank you very much for joining us on this rainy Thursday. I call this meeting of the House Community Regional Affairs to order. It is now 8:02 a.m., Thursday, March 16th, 2023, in Capitol Room 124. Members present are Vice Chair McCabe, Representative McKay, Representative Ruffridge, Representative Himshute, and I also heard from Representative Pawtucket. He will be joining us a little late this morning, and myself, Rep. McCormick. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please take this time to silence your cell phones for the duration of the meeting. Before we begin, I would like to thank Linda Jensen, the House Community and Regional Affairs Secretary from Records, and Sydney Truitt from the Juneau LIO for staffing the committee today. I would also like to thank my staff, Mina Ryan, for being the committee aide this morning, and also being kind enough to make everyone cupcakes on her own birthday. Aww. So happy birthday, Mina. And that's impressive. I don't know if I could get up in the morning and make cupcakes on my own birthday. So if anyone needs one, I think she has a whole tray of them. So please feel free to request a cupcake. So anyways, today we are hearing three bills. First up is House Bill 61 by Speaker Tilton regarding limitations on firearms and restrictions. Second, we are hearing House Bill 17 by Representative Carrick on contraceptives coverage. And third, we will be having a second hearing of House Bill 78 by myself regarding Community Health Aid Appreciation Day. And that will have public testimony. Is there anything from the committee before we get started this morning? No. Okay. All right. In that case, we'll take a brief at ease to allow Speaker Tilton and Stephen St. Clair, staff to Speaker Tilton to come forward. Brief at ease. All right. We are now back on the record. Please, Speaker Tilton and Mr. St. Clair, introduce your bill.
All right. Thank you. Good morning to everyone. My name is Kathy Tilton, House District 26 Representative. And I want to say thank you so much for giving us the opportunity to present House Bill 61 to you today. I appreciate the opportunity. House Bill 61 is a bill that is something that addresses maybe not an issue that's happening right now in our state, but something did happen during the time of the pandemic where there was emergency orders made by governors and mayors to shut down stores that sold firearms, ammo, and gun ranges. The bill itself just affirms that Alaskans have the right to survive and to protect themselves, and we also have a Second Amendment right. It just stipulates that the state, municipalities, and other instrumentalities of the state may not implement any new restrictions to access firearms, ammunition, or accessories, or shooting ranges resulting from a disaster declaration. One thing I want to make clear is that nothing in HB 61 changes what is already in our statute, so it doesn't change any of the laws that are already there that are on firearms. So with that, I am going to turn it over to my trusted staff, Stephen St. Clair here, to read the sectional analysis as well as do a presentation. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
For the record, my name is Steve St. Clair, staff to Representative Tilton, District 26. If we'll move to the sectional, Section 1 prohibits states and municipalities and instruments of the government, as Representative Tilton stated, from doing certain things under a disaster declaration. They cannot prohibit or restrict possession or use of firearm accessories, or ammunition. Order the seizure of the above referenced items, and actually federal law prohibits that, limiting the quantity and restrictions on sales and service of those items, Number four is key here. This is one that a lot of people don't quite understand. Closing or limiting the hours of operation for retail establishments that sell and service those items unless the closure or limitation applies to all other forms of commerce within the jurisdiction. This means it's equity in commerce. If you close down everything, if the disaster declaration closes everything, gun stores will close too. This does not give them an exception to stay open. This just says equity. If you're going to keep open liquor stores, if you're going to keep open bingo halls, you have to keep open gun stores, firearms, etc. It's just equity in commerce.
I would like to just quickly note, sorry to interrupt, we were joined by Representative Rauscher at 8:08 a.m. Welcome, Representative Rauscher.
Number five is closing or restricting, limiting the hours of operations of shooting ranges. And I'll get into the importance of these later. Suspending or revoking concealed carry permits outside of current statutory provisions. In other words, if you're legally authorized to carry, have a concealed carry, it cannot be revoked during a time of disaster declaration unless you have done something illegal and are no longer authorized to have a concealed carry. Seven, refusing to accept application for concealed carry. It's just business as usual. That's all we're asking for. Equity and commerce. Provide for civil action relief as violation of the above referenced prohibitions. It's currently in statute. This is nothing new. We are not, as Speaker Tilton stated, we are not creating new laws. We are not creating new laws, giving exceptions to firearm industry. This is just equity across the board. Nine provides definition of firearm and firearm accessory. It's the exact same definition that is in statute now. However, as a technical change, they had to place it back in statute. And then you'll see the last thing, Section 2, repeals previous definition of firearm accessories. This is just a technical change drafting that occurs when a definition appears twice within the same statute. Now, if we'll go to the slides. HB 61, an act relating to the restriction of firearms and other weapons. HB 61 is critical to the Alaskan way of life. It deals with subsistence, protection, and the Constitution. I will elaborate more on this throughout the presentation. As we know that subsistence is a way of life, and restricting firearms during a declared disaster limits villages and Alaskans to subsist. Let me go to the next slide. Getting ahead of myself. Firearm restrictions impact subsistence. Subsistence, here's a definition of subsistence. 21% of Alaska's population is considered rural, and rural Alaskan residents harvest about 18,000 tons of wild food per year. In an Alaskan rural community, 30% of the community provides 70% of the food for that community. The largest annual per capita is what in Alaska rural villages in 2017 is about 402 pounds per person. And then nowhere else in the states is a state so reliant on wild food. Now, with this, I'm just a couple of key points that I didn't put up there. In a natural disaster, if we look at what happened in western Alaska, September of last year, when they had the floodings, the flooding and the storms that hit the western coast, a disaster declaration was declared. And some of the research I've done is houses were lifted off the foundation, weapons could have been lost. So if they cannot gain access to new weapons, fixed broken weapons, etc., they're not going to have the ability to subsist. Impact on protections. This year, we all heard about the woman and her child that was mauled by a polar bear in Wales. The polar bear was killed by a man with a gun. We have to protect ourselves. In 2017, a contract employee for Pogo Mine was killed by a black bear while collecting soil samples. The bear was killed by a man employee with a mine employee with a gun. Guns are imperative. Guns are Alaskan way of life. When people go hiking, They take bear spray or guns. Some places they go, they take a gun because bear spray just isn't going to do it based on the population of bears. Firearm restrictions in the Constitution. In January 2022, a federal appeals court ruled that two California counties that shut down gun stores as non-essential businesses due to the coronavirus violated the Second Amendment, the Constitution's Second Amendment. The Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution guarantees the right of the people to keep and bear arms. In 2008, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in the District of Columbia versus Heller that this individual right does not require participating in militias. You don't have to be in a militia to have the right to bear arms. In 2010, the High Court ruled in McDonald versus Chicago that the right to keep and bear arms is a fundamental right that also applies to the states through the 14th Amendment, which bars any state from denying liberty to a person without due cause. Selective firearm restrictions violate Alaskan's Second Amendment right to bear arms. And then coming out and looking at it from a wider scope, four other states have adopted legislation in 2021 to include South Dakota, Georgia, West Virginia, and North Dakota. This legislation is based off of legislation that was passed in those states in 2021. Additionally, HB 61 is written verbatim of legislation passed last year in the Senate. There's no changes to it. It passed unanimously in the Senate. When it got over to the House, last minute, we didn't have the votes to go from second to third on the floor.
So timing issue.
It was a timing issue. It wasn't because of content or context of the bill, but it was a timing issue. In conclusion, firearms and firearm accessories and ammunition are part of the Alaskan way of life and culture. Firearm facilities need firearm facilities feeding families are facilitates. Can't even read my own writing. Facilitates family and food security. Firearms allow Alaskans and visitors to safely explore our beautiful state. Second Amendment grants citizens' rights to bear arms. And again, just as we were speaking about, SB 136 did pass the House or the Senate unanimously, and HB 179, just due to timing issues, did not pass. What questions do you have?
First of all, I just wanted to thank you first for presenting and also just for spotlighting the importance of subsistence hunting in our communities. But I'll, Vice Chair McCabe, if you had a question or comment.
Thanks. Through the chair, Mr. St. Clair, I'm curious. We talk about gun stores, but typically gun stores don't just carry guns. They carry bows, arrows, ammunition, fishing poles, fishing lures, all those types of things that we would need for subsistence in some sort of a emergency grid down on the West Coast where we're not getting food up here, something like that. During the COVID crisis, when they closed down all the sporting goods businesses because they sold guns, they also limited our abilities to get to those things that some people don't consider quite as dangerous as guns, such as fishing poles. And I mean, I think that I'd like to think I'm just as dangerous with a bow, but maybe that's an opinion. So, maybe we need to highlight that a little bit better, that it's that guns are often not the only thing sold in one of these stores, that the very essence of Alaskans and our right to subsist and our right to protect ourselves and from four-legged creatures as well as two-legged creatures are tied into this bill. And it just seems a shame to watch the political ideology of a mayor who doesn't like guns shut down fishing poles and bow and arrow things as well. So just because of the guns sold in the store. So I don't see this so much as a Second Amendment or gun thing. I see this as essential and critical to Alaskans, but also as a free market economy thing. You can't pick and choose which business you want to, because oftentimes businesses don't sell just one thing, such as guns. And so anyways, it's more of a comment probably. You don't really need to answer, but thanks.
Thank you, Vice Chair McCabe. Speaker Tilton.
Yeah, thank you, through the chair, Representative McCabe. I appreciate your comments, and there is always an attempt to make this into something that it's not. It doesn't create any new laws. It doesn't change laws that are already there for protections for certain places. But it does allow that in a time of a pandemic under that there's equity and that the stores are open and that Alaskans can continue the way of life that we're used to. I appreciate your comments. Thank you, Representative McCabe.
Representative Hemshoot.
Thank you. Through the chair, I'm looking at the Municipality of Anchorage hunker down order that was in effect for 1 week, March 22nd to the 31st in 2020. And it has a list of essential businesses. Basically, you're looking to add firearms, shall we say, purveyors, to that list of essential businesses.
Through the chair, Representative Hemshoot, no. What we're looking for is equity. If you close one, you close all. If you don't, essential services is kind of a relative term and based on perspective. As Representative McCabe brought up, firearm stores don't just sell firearms. It's about equity. And if it's the government or an entity picking winners and losers, it's just equity across the board. Additionally, I'm sorry, Department of Homeland Security published a memo that actually included firearms manufacturers and stores as mission essential in a memorandum dated 10 August 2021. I'm not sure if I put that in your packet or not, but if not, I can get it there.
Okay. Follow up?
Representative Hemshoot.
Thank you. Through the chair, can you tell me what the difference is between equity and equality? I want to understand why you're using the word equity versus equality.
Through the chair, Representative Hemshoot, I believe that they are at the core of the same word.
Vice Chair McCabe.
Thank you. So equality would be, in my opinion, if you leave your restaurant south open in Anchorage, then you needed to leave all restaurants south. Equity seems to be a bigger word. If you leave one business open, you have to leave all businesses open, essentially. So just kind of my take on the whole Anchorage thing. We closed down big box sporting goods stores, and yet we kept the mayor's restaurants open. To me, that doesn't seem equitable, if that makes sense.
I'll keep thinking about it. Thank you.
Representative Mears.
Thank you. I think I've received more emails on this than just about anything else on both sides of it. And one of the comments struck me that was kind of reinforced in the presentation is we do have a lot of protections with our Second Amendment. Very largely in Alaska, recognize the benefit of access to firearms, accessories, ammunition, and all the rest of that. But I'm kind of seeing the comments striking me is that this is a solution in search of a problem. As was reiterated in the presentation, there's a lot of these protections that already exist. And I think with some of the case law that came out after the pandemic, that further reinforced a lot of rights. So I don't know if you wanted to expound on that anymore, but that's where I'm thinking right now. Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Mears, I appreciate that, but right now we want to be able to ensure in our state that we are do not have our firearm stores, because it is such a way of life of Alaskans. We want to ensure that those remain open during and are not closed under the guise of a pandemic.
Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair McCormick. Thank you, Speaker Tilton and Mr. St. Clair. I think, I'll echo what Representative Mears was saying about the number of emails. And I try to read all of those to make sure that I have a good understanding of what everyone is thinking. 100% agree with the need to keep stores open and have that equity or equality for each individual store owner. I think some of the comments that I received, at least in opposition to the bill, are all in line 8 of the first page regarding forbidding the possession, use, or transfer of a firearm accessory, ammunition, or other weapon for personal use. And some of the concerns are that that doesn't necessarily fall into the purchase or sale of a firearm, but rather concerns that in a disaster declaration, an individual would be allowed to essentially carry a firearm in places where they're currently prohibited, whether that is into a shelter or into the Capitol or a library, school, things like that. Could you maybe speak a little bit about the intent of line one, how that relates to the sale of firearms or the opening of stores and things of that nature, or maybe address some of the concerns from the folks that had spoken out with concerns about that line?
Through the chair, Representative Ruffridge, what this does, and when it comes to shelters, Red Cross has guidance that says they are going to monitor for weapons, drugs, alcohol coming into shelters. However, current law, federal law says if it's not prohibited right now, it can't be prohibited in the location. I.e., if a shelter is, better example, if a shelter is in a school, such as what happened in Western Alaska during that time, weapons are prohibited by federal law and state law from being in schools. You can't carry at that shelter. If the shelter is on a military installation, you can't carry because you can't carry there normally. If a shelter is set up in the Walmart parking lot, there is no federal or state law that prohibits carrying in the Walmart parking lot, so there it would be legal. Another example of when this was tested was during Hurricane Katrina. There was what we called trailer camps because they had FEMA camps because they brought the trailers down for everyone. FEMA said you can't carry any weapons into the campers with you or the trailers with you. They were challenged by a group, and they actually rescinded that and said that, yes, you can carry in that because it wasn't in something that was already prohibited. And when it comes to just normal carry, this is just saying you can't restrict it. If I'm authorized to carry a weapon, which most Alaskans are unless you're a felon, Lautenberg Amendment, etc., you're authorized to carry. You can't tell me that I can't carry in a place that I normally could just because it's an emergency. However, orders can be given, martial law. Trust me, we can go to extremes and identify where, yes, the government can tell you, but that's not what this legislation does. This just reinforces your ability to carry where you're authorized to carry right now.
And just to follow up, if I may.
Representative Ruffridge.
So to sort of condense that down just a tad, so under this bill, in the issue of a disaster, places that you were previously forbidden to carry a weapon, you would still be forbidden to carry that weapon. I think that is mostly the concern. And so I just wanted to make sure that that was what you were saying.
Thanks, sir.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Through the chair, also, we have invited testimony we can do afterwards or can assist with some of these questions.
Vice Chair McCabe, I know you had a question.
Thank you.
Or comment.
Yeah, so you mentioned Katrina in New Orleans, Mayor Ray Nagin, I think. And he did exactly what you just said, is he limited, in fact, they confiscated firearms. So some of the comments I got were very concerned about this sort of thing, about, well, we have police to protect us. But New Orleans proved that is wasn't true. There were many, many instances where there were no police around because of the civil unrest or because they were busy elsewhere. You know, and frankly, we don't have one policeman for every, you know, one law enforcement officer for every situation. So the cops are busy elsewhere, and the rampant crime and lawlessness is over here. And Mayor Nagin had confiscated guns and refused people's right to protect themselves, and the cops were busy elsewhere. So if I understand you right, you're saying that that would be a mayor of a city could not say nobody carries guns, or we're going to confiscate all the guns because we're worried about civil unrest, so we're going to take away your ability to protect yourself.
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, that exact situation, like you said, with Mayor Nagy in New Orleans, was challenged, and it was found to be unconstitutional. So there's case law saying that your weapons cannot be confiscated as a result of a disaster declaration. And again, I have to caveat on this by saying, or reinforce, if you are legally authorized to carry a legal weapon, it cannot be confiscated unless it's evidence in a crime or you no longer have the ability to carry it, meaning you've lost that due to a crime.
Vice Chairman McCabe.
So this doesn't necessarily mean that there's going to be armed vigilantes running around New Orleans. This simply means what we all know is that an armed society, a society with the ability to protect itself, is generally pretty polite. Even the gun owner knows, even during an emergency, that if he initiates something, he's going to be held liable for it. You know, just having a gun makes you even more polite because you're held to a higher standard. Would that be a correct statement, sir?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe.
Yes.
Thank you.
Representative McKay.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, and thank you for being here today. I have a question and a comment. The comment is, you know, I have a 12-gauge tactical shotgun that I take to my cabin for in case there's a bear underneath the cabin, right? And I've got a box of shells. And, you know, it's pretty easy to go through a box of shells. My understanding is that when Mayor Berkowitz did his lockdown of Anchorage, I couldn't even go buy a box of shells. So we're not talking about going in and buying a, you know, AR-15 or something. We're just talking about ammunition just to, you know, for shotguns and stuff. So how long was the Berkowitz lockdown? How long did that last?
To the chair, Representative McKay, it was 10 days.
10 days, okay. I mean, to me, it's 10 minutes is too long. So I'm a proud sponsor of this bill, and I'd be happy to vote yes on it when we get to it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are there any more questions? All right. Thank you very much for presenting. I do believe we have some invited testimony to bring up. I only have, I believe, only one testifier here, and that's Ms. Klein.
Ms. Klein, yeah. Aveen Klein.
Aveen Klein, okay. Ms. Klein, if you'd like to come forward.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair McCormick, the honorable members of the committee. For the record, my name is Aveen Klein, State Director for the NRA. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House Bill 61 on behalf of the NRA's tens of thousands of members in Alaska. House Bill 61 protects Alaskans' constitutional rights to keep and bear arms from government infringement under the declaration of an emergency disaster. House Bill 61 prevents the state and municipalities from acting under the color of this disaster emergency declaration to arbitrarily infringe on Alaskans' rights to keep and bear arms. This bill also provides and avoids improperly placing the burden of proof on a business owner to establish that a firearms business is critical or essential in an emergency. At the core of the Second Amendment is the right to self-defense. The importance of this right is elevated in times of chaos, uncertainty, and emergency. Alaskans must be able to access firearms, ammunition, shooting ranges, and other essential firearms-related businesses under these emergencies. House Bill 61 provides a thoughtful and effective approach to balance Second Amendment rights and local control. In recent years, the NRA has worked with 10 states to implement or expand emergency powers protections similar to House Bill 61. You may hear that this bill puts firearm industry on a pedestal and somehow treats them differently than any other business. This is blatantly incorrect. House Bill 61 gives a government entity the ability to close a firearms business in an emergency. They just can't single them out. But any closure must apply equally across all forms of commerce. For example, a governmental entity cannot close a firearms store while allowing a marijuana dispensary across the street to stay open. And yes, we saw this example occur as recently as during the COVID closures in Alaska. This bill does not allow unlawful behavior with firearms. This bill does not allow otherwise prohibited persons to own guns or purchase firearms in an emergency. This is expressly laid out in the bill. The constitutionality of this bill has been upheld by the Ninth Circuit, and this decision was made prior to the New York State Rifle Pistol Association versus Bruin test, a recent U.S. Supreme Court decision. The Bruin decision expressly laid out a public, the Bruin decision expressly rejected a public safety or interest balancing test previously used to argue for the constitutionality of gun control measures. The Bruin test states that any restriction on firearms must have been within the history, text, and tradition of firearms regulations at the time the Constitution was drafted. House Bill 61 is necessary because we saw these infringements as recent as 2 years ago in Alaska. This is not a solution in search of a problem. It is addressing recent problems. Even with recent case law to uphold these protections, we have continually seen these types of infringements. This bill does not allow a firearm to be carried in places that are otherwise unlawful under current law. The right to keep and bear arms is a fundamental right. So fundamental, it is enshrined in the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of Alaska. House Bill 61 is about the Constitution, and it is about food security for Alaskans. I respectfully request your support of House Bill 61, and I'd be happy to address any questions from the committee. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony this morning, Ms. Klein. I do believe we have a question and or comment from Vice Chair McCabe.
Thanks, Ms. Klein. So I appreciated what you said about midway through what you were talking about. It addresses number four in the bill. And it says that, and you said that gun stores don't want to be singled out. They don't want to be put on a pedestal. They don't want to be open if everything else is closed. They just want equity in their treatment with other businesses. So there is at least one gun rights advocacy group in Alaska that is opposing this bill because of number four. And so I am curious, I'm an NRA life member and I'm looking for direction from the group that I pay dues to. And I just want confirmation that the NRA is in support of this bill, because it's a holistic bill, because it doesn't treat gun owners or gun stores any better or any worse than any other business. That's my question.
Yes. through the chair, thank you, Vice Chair McCabe. That's correct. What this bill seeks to do is not put firearm owners on a pedestal. It is saying that firearm stores can be closed under an emergency, but that is only if it is applied equally across all forms of commerce, that they can't be singled out. And that's what we saw happen in COVID. That's what we saw happen in Katrina, as was previously testified to. This bill simply states that you cannot single out a firearms industry, a retailer, a manufacturer, a distributor, You cannot single them out. It is not treating them differently. We just want to be treated the same.
Thank you.
Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair McCormick. And thank you for being online today. I'll pass along the same, questions regarding on page one, line eight, which is number one, about forbidding the possession or use or transfer of firearms. You mentioned it in your testimony that the previous prohibitions under law, if it was prohibited before, it would be prohibited during a disaster. Can you just speak to that just a little bit more and flesh that out? Because that's currently just a few of the concerns that folks have mentioned to me.
Yes, thank you for the question and through the chair to address. This bill does not change current state law in regards to where you can and cannot possess or lawfully carry a firearm. This bill does not change that. It does not remove those prohibitions under an emergency. It simply states that in an emergency, you cannot add new colors of control and change where you can and cannot carry. Again, this doesn't address current state law. It does not change that. It just says in an emergency, you cannot add the prohibition.
Thank you.
Are there any additional questions? Representative McKay.
Yeah, just like, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, I just want to follow up on my previous comments. I mean, the Berkowitz lockdown was 10 days, but it could have been much longer. You know, he had the power to shut down what he did for, could have been months. So it's the principle here. It's not, well, maybe a day is okay or 5 days is okay. 2 weeks is not okay. I mean, it's just not okay at all, right? I mean, would you like to address that a little bit? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, thank you for the question or the comment and through the chair to address. If I can quote Dr. Martin Luther King, is a right delayed is a right denied. If any infringement, no matter how long, to a fundamental right is a denial of that right, whether that is 10 days or 100 days or 2 years or 10 minutes. That an infringement on a fundamental right, whether it's the right to keep or bear arms or the right to free speech, that is what this bill is addressing. Thank you.
Representative Hemshoot.
Thank you. Through the chair, I just want to be really clear. My previous question about this list from the COVID shutdown in Anchorage. So you don't want gun sales facilities to be added to this list of essential services. I'm sorry, I was asking here, not Ms. Klein. Apologies.
Through the chair, Representative Hemshoot, there shouldn't be a list. It's either all or nothing. If they want to shut everything down, shut everything down.
Follow up?
Representative Hemshoot.
So on this list are things like emergency services.
That, through the chair, Representative Hemshoot, emergency services should be open regardless.
Okay.
If you are looking for a prospective list, Homeland Security did provide a list, but again, they're just looking for equity.
Okay. I don't want to parse the list, but thank you. I think that answers my question.
Sorry, through the chair, Representative Hemshoot, just to kind of expound on that, there's a difference between government services and private industry. Government services would not change police, fire, EMS, etc. However, private industry, that's what we're looking for, is the equity there.
Through the chair, if I may comment.
Representative Hemshoot.
So if a hardware store is open, a place selling ammo should be open.
Through the chair, Representative Hemshoot, yes.
Thank you.
Are there any additional questions? No? Okay. Well, thank you both very much for presenting this morning. We will be having public testimony for House Bill 61 on March 21st. I will set the amendment deadline for House Bill 61 to Sunday, March 19th at 3 p.m. Thank you very much again for presenting this morning. We will now take a brief at ease as we prepare to hear the next bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and the committee.
We're now back on the record. Thank you, Rep. Carrick, and staff to Rep. Carrick, Sherry Bowman, for coming forward. I'd like to quickly note for the record that we were joined by Representative Pupkatuk at 8:45 a.m. Rep. Carrick, please go ahead. Get started.
Great. Thank you so much. Good morning, Chair McCormick and members of the Community and Regional Affairs Committee. My name is Ashley Carrick. I'm the state representative for House District 35, which is in West Fairbanks. And I'd like to thank you all for hearing House Bill 17 today. Currently, there are 28 states that require health insurance plans regulated by the state that provide coverage of prescription drugs and devices to also cover prescription contraceptives. This aligns with the federal mandate that was laid out in a provision of the 2010 Affordable Care Act's health coverage guarantee, requiring non-grandfathered health insurance coverage and employer-sponsored group health plans to cover preventative services without cost sharing. And then, as recommended by the Institute of Medicine and defined by the Health Resources and Services Administration, women's preventative services include all contraceptives approved by the FDA and patient education and counseling for women of reproductive capacity as prescribed by a healthcare provider, collectively referred to as contraceptive services. The final preventative rules issued in 2012 required insurers and group health plans to cover all such contraceptive services. Furthermore, 22 states and the District of Columbia have ensured that women can receive an extended supply of contraceptive methods at one time, usually a 12-month supply, rather than a typical 1 or 3 month supply. So what House Bill 17 does is it puts into Alaska statutes language consistent with standards set in the federal contraceptive coverage guarantee, and also mandates coverage for dispensing up to 12 months of prescription contraceptives at a time. Primarily, this legislation is being brought before the committee because it allows women in rural communities and those who work extended shifts in remote locations to have a continuous supply of contraception. Research featured in the Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology in your bill packet shows that women who are dispensed a 12-month supply of contraceptives have a 30% drop in unplanned pregnancies and a 46% drop in the likelihood of abortions that women compared to women dispensed a 1 to 3 month supply. House Bill 17 can also save money for the state. In reviewing the prior version of this legislation, in a previous session, the former Department of Health and Social Services fiscal note had estimated a $1.3 million savings annually due to a reduction in unplanned pregnancy. And as you can see, we do have zero fiscal notes attached to this bill, though it is possible that we could see savings in the long term as unintended pregnancies and the associated care for those pregnancies drops. I'm bringing forward House Bill 17 because not only is it often time-consuming and inconvenient to obtain a prescription contraceptive every 1 to 3 months, but also because I know that improved access to contraception means improved health for women and families. Providers are still able to make decisions in consultation with their patients on what type and length of prescription to provide. Currently, providers can provide up to 12 months of prescription birth control, but a person cannot pick up that prescription and receive coverage for the full 12 months at the pharmacy. So this bill takes insurance coverage away as a barrier to access. Additionally, there's been an increased awareness in Alaska on the national level of the issue of domestic violence and sexual assault. So House Bill 17 has an additional benefit, helping protect victims of domestic violence, especially regarding reproductive coercion or contraceptive coercion, where abusers dictate when and how contraceptives can or cannot be accessed as a means of gaining power and control. So reducing the number of times a person has to go to the pharmacy or to see a provider improves that ability for safety. Supported by a strong, longstanding body of evidence, contraceptive services have been recognized by both government and a wide range of private sector experts as a vital and effective component of preventative and public health care. Contraceptive use helps women avoid unintended pregnancy and improve birth spacing, which in turn has substantial positive consequences for infants, women, families, and society. House Bill 17 just makes sense for Alaskan women and families. And at this point, I want to turn it over to my staff, Sherry Bowman, to explain the sectional and to go over the summary of changes from our previous committee of referral.
Thank you, Chair McCormick and members of the committee. Through the chair, for the record, my name is Sherry Bowman, and I am staff to Representative Carrick, and I appreciate you hearing House Bill 17 today. So House Bill 17 puts into Alaska statutes language that is consistent with the standards set in the federal contraceptive coverage guarantee. House Bill 17 also requires health insurers to, at the request of the consumer and in consultation with the health care provider, cover a 12-month supply of contraceptives at one time and provide reimbursement to a health care provider or dispensing entity. So Section 1 of the bill lays this out. Section 1 also gives health care insurers the ability to enact reasonable cost containment measures and prevents an insurer from offsetting the costs of compliance. In subsection D, cost containment is defined as incentivizing the use of generic or lower-cost medications or the use of healthcare providers or pharmacies that offer services or prescriptions at a lower rate. The inclusion of this language gives insurers the ability to steer towards generics as a cost containment strategy, a provision that the Department of Administration had previously advocated for as it could substantially reduce their costs in covering a 12-month supply of birth control. However, subsection F states, if the covered therapeutically equivalent version of a prescription contraceptive is not available or is considered medically inadvisable by the healthcare provider of the insured, a healthcare insurer shall provide coverage without cost sharing for an alternative therapeutically equivalent version of the prescription contraceptive that is prescribed for the insured. The inclusion of this language establishes that even though insurers will be allowed to steer towards generics, if a particular generic or brand is determined medically inappropriate by the healthcare provider, then the insurer must accommodate the insured. Finally, subsection H includes a religious exemption, so health plans sponsored by certain exempt religious employers are not subject to the requirements of Section 1. Section 2 amends AS 2910-200 by adding a provision applying to home rule municipalities. Section 3 amends AS 2920 by adding a new section clarifying that municipal health care insurance plans that are self-insured are subject to the requirements of Section 1. Section 4 amends AS 393090 subsection A, which relates to policies of group insurance covering state employees, by adding a new subsection 13 to capture group health insurance policies covering employees of a participating governmental unit. Section 5 amends AS 393091, which relates to self-insurance and excess loss insurance, by adding language to capture a self-insured group medical plan covering active state employees. Sections 4 and 5 clarify that the requirements of Section 1 apply to active state employees. Section 6 directs the Department of Health to cover the 12-month supply of prescription contraceptives for eligible recipients of medical assistance. Section 7 directs the Department of Health to amend and submit for federal approval a state plan for medical assistance coverage consistent with Section 6. Section 8 is a conditional effect of Section 6 of the bill, and Section 9 pertains to effective dates. And before we go to questions, I would just like to go over the summary of changes from the last committee. Under Section 1, subsection A1B, this was deleted to remove emergency contraception language from the bill and relettered accordingly. And in Section 7, references to emergency contraception were also removed. I'll note for the committee that we do have Director Lori Winghire from the Division of Insurance online for invited testimony, and Charles Semling, lead pharmacist for the Division of Healthcare Services, is also available for questions. And we would be happy to answer any questions that the committee has. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Vice Chair McCabe.
Thanks. So I'm a guy, so I have to take the word of those women that surround me. Not that many women surround me, but I do. I do have sisters and a wife, so what I'm curious about is they are worried that at 12 months, if they just automatically take month 12, that it will not be as effective, or their body chemistry and hormones may have changed to the point where it's not so effective. So I guess my question is this mandatory or is it voluntary? Can the doctor say, hey, I want to see you again in 6 months. I'm only going to give you a 6-month prescription because your body's changing right now. And I don't think that 12 months from now, what I'm giving you right now will be effective. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So through the chair to Vice Chair McCabe, it's a great question. And the provider still has full control over what they believe is the right prescription for the individual. And just anecdotally, I know that most providers, especially as someone is beginning use of a new birth control method, may want to just prescribe that 1 or 3 month prescription and then have you do a follow-up visit. For someone who's already using a birth control method like a contraceptive pill and it's working really well, they may go ahead and say, okay, you can have a 12-month prescription. And so there's that consultation that still exists and is unchanged with this legislation between the provider and the patient.
Well,
Vice Chair McCabe.
So do we know, and Ms. Wingheier is probably not the person to answer that, but from maybe Representative Ruffridge can answer this, but do we know that, say a woman goes 6-8 months without a doctor's appointment and her hormones are changed and she thinks she is taking a contraceptive and it won't work because her body chemistry has changed and this contraceptive that she thinks is going to protect her won't work. And from a pro-life standpoint, from my personal views, you can see where I'm going with this. If it doesn't work, now we have a different issue. So I'm just wondering, from a doctor or maybe a pharmacist perspective, if that's a possibility. I don't know, maybe this question, since you're the expert, maybe this question is better for you.
Representative Ruffridge, if you'd like to.
Thank you. Through the chair, happy to speak to that in a professional capacity of some sort. Oral contraception is never 100% effective. They come close to 100%, but in counseling patients, you make sure that you explain often, and especially with a new contraception prescription, that it is not 100% effective. And some of those actually, especially the low-dose versions of contraception, require that you take those prescription medications within essentially almost the same hour of every day. That being said, there's very few alterations to body chemistry that affect contraception in general. Most of that would be, a significant medical event if that were to occur. But one of the reasons why I think House Bill 17 helps cover some of the gaps is in a pharmacy setting, some of the more emergent refill prescriptions are women who didn't realize that they needed a refill. Now they're out of refills, and they didn't take their medication that morning, and they were due to take it, and it's a low dose prescription. And if they don't take it, then the situation that you described has the potential to arise. So I think having that length of time at the doctor's request to be able to say, yeah, I can take this on a regular basis, I'm not going to get surprised when I go to the pharmacy and I don't have access to it, actually has the potential of keeping those really low dose prescription medications on schedule at the right time. When the alarm is set, they have a medication available to take. So not sure if that answered your question all the way, but
no, I through the chair, I appreciate it. Sorry to sort of hijack your bill, Representative Carrick, but nice having the expert sitting right next to you, right?
Representative McKay, and we have Representative Mears. Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Representative Carrick, for bringing this to us. I had four daughters, and I always told my wife, that's your area, you handle that, I don't want to know. But
if I understand correctly, the fundamental problem here is if a lady goes to her doctor and says, I'm going on a really long trip to Antarctica or somewhere, or I'm going to go whaling in the Beaufort Sea for several months, can you prescribe me a 12-month dose? The issue here is the insurance won't pay for it?
Yes.
So is that what we're trying to fix?
Yeah, through the chair to Representative McKay, that's exactly the gap we're trying to fix. So right now, a provider can prescribe 12 months of a birth control or a contraceptive. And the gap is that if you then go to the pharmacist to pick up that prescription, you will not be able to receive coverage for more than 1 to 3 months, depending on the type. And so we're trying to make it so that folks who live in rural Alaska, for example, and maybe only come into a hub community where they can see a provider less than 1 to 3 months at a time, or maybe they work in a field like the fishing industry or field work doing research, so that they can go and get that prescription that they've already been prescribed and receive coverage for it and not have to worry about the gap in coverage.
Quick follow-up.
So your bill, you believe, would force insurance coverage to take care of that? And you think that would happen if we pass this?
Through the chair to Representative McKay, yes. And we also, I just want to note, we do have Director Wingheyer on the line from Division of Insurance, and so she could speak to kind of the, validity of this bill covering that issue for sure.
Representative Mears.
Thank you, through the chair. So as the rest of the representatives in this room, I am not living in my home district during the length of the session. As I was preparing to come down here, one of the things that I did was I filled multiple refills of my prescriptions as was prescribed to me by my doctor, so that as I'm down here without a car, with different circumstances, away from my home pharmacy, it's something that I didn't have to worry about for my length of term here. My understanding is what this bill does is it just brings contraceptives on parity with other medications.
Through the chair to Representative Mears, that is correct.
Thank you, Representative Mears. So we do have some invited testimony to get to, but just want to provide the opportunity if anyone else had any questions before moving on to that or comments. Okay, so I believe we have Director Wingheyer on the phone. Ms. Wingheyer, if you'd like to go ahead and provide testimony and maybe just answer some of the questions that have flown around here in the last couple of minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, this is Lori Wingheyer. I'm the Director of the Division of Insurance for the State of Alaska. Sir, I don't have any testimony to provide, but I certainly will answer questions of the committee members.
Ms. Wingheyer, were you listening to our previous conversation? Was there maybe anything you wanted to add to some of the discussion we were having?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have listened to the testimony for this bill in hearing, and the only thing I can add is to clarify that, yes, insurance, this is not going to get in the middle of a provider and the insurance company. This is not going to stop the provider from having the responsibilities he or she would have to a patient. It is simply saying that once a birth control method contraceptive is provided, then the patient will have the right or the ability to get a 12-month supply. For all the reasons that I've heard, you're going on a trip to Antarctica, or you're whaling, or you're working in Pluto, you're fishing, what have you. It is just a matter of convenience for women to get their prescription for a longer period of time than what they are now. We have not had any rebuttal or opposition from the insurance companies on HB 17. I hope that answers the questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Director Wingheyer. Representative Butkita.
Yeah, just for the record, I want to clarify there's not much time for finagling on whaling. That's the only subject matter. That's the only subject matter expertise that I provide for this conversation. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Pachatuk. Representative Himshute.
Oh, my question was not for Ms. Wingheyer.
Okay.
I just wanted to make a comment at the end.
Okay. Are there any questions for Ms. Wingheyer? Okay. We will now hear from Carl Semling.
And Mr. Chair, I believe he's just for questions.
Just for questions.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Does anyone have any questions? He's the pharmacist that we have on the line. No? Okay. In that case, comments. Representative Hemshute.
Thank you. Through the chair, I wanted to thank Representative Carrick for bringing this, and it is decades overdue. This would have made a difference in my life in many of the jobs that I held, and I know that the young women of Southeast Alaska who fish in Bristol Bay, who go on extended fishing trips in Southeast, and all of the other things that young women do are going to benefit from this legislation. So if I had realized this was how we fixed this problem that I experienced in my lifetime, maybe I would have run for office sooner. So thank you for bringing this.
Any other questions or comments for Representative Carrick this morning? Representative Mears.
Thank you to the chair. I would just like to echo the sentiments of Representative Hemshute as the only other woman on this panel. This is decades overdue. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
If I might, Mr. Chair, if I could
Representative Carrick, please
add a wrap-up comment on the conversation. I just want to really emphasize that this House Bill 17 is an insurance bill on it at its core. Fundamentally, we're not changing contraceptive coverage. We're not changing that relationship between the provider. We are changing what happens when you go to the pharmacist once you have a prescription. And I also just want to note that there has been quite a number of Alaskans who have submitted some opposition, and I believe that we addressed most of those concerns by removing the language around emergency contraception in the previous committee of referral. And I just would encourage folks to come and talk to our office, and we'll continue to communicate with folks that may still be in opposition just to help kind of illuminate what the purpose of this legislation is and what we're trying to do for women in Alaska. And just thank you again for hearing this bill, which, as a few of the members of this committee have said, is long overdue and will make a big difference in the lives of women across the state.
Thank you very much for presenting this morning, Representative Carrick and Ms. Bowman. Let's see. I will set an amendment deadline for HB 17 for Sunday, March 19th at 3 p.m. We will be taking up public testimony for this bill on March 21st. We'll now call on at ease to transition to our next bill. Brief at ease. I now call the meeting of the House Community and Regional Affairs Committee back to order. We are now on House Bill 78. We are having public testimony this morning for 78. Ms. Chyflik-Sifsoff, you could just briefly come up and just kind of refresh us on what our bill is all about. Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you. Through the chair. My name is Callan Chyflik-Sifsoff, and I am a staff with Representative McCormick. I'm also a constituent of District 37 and grew up in Aleutianik, Alaska. And so personally, this bill is a representative of my community and the health aides that I've known throughout my life. So as we heard from the presentation on the last hearing, the role of community health aides in Alaska is immense and can't be understated. In every aspect of the role, people throughout our state work very hard each day, 24 hours a day, to provide emergency medical treatment and just standard daily medical treatment, as well as coordinate with entities and doctors and nurses to provide all aspects of healthcare to a majority of our state. So for that reason, we do have a person here that would like to testify, and thank you for hearing this bill.
Thank you very much, Ms. Feiklik-Sisoff. Are there any questions before we get started on public testimony? Okay, thank you very much. We will now open for public testimony. So I see that we have one testifier today for public testimony. That is Ms. Nancy Bale. If you could come forward, state your name on the record. I'll give you 3 minutes, but I'll be generous, since you're the only person here, so please.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Nancy Bale. I'm a school nurse in Anchorage, Alaska, and I've also worked at the Alaska Military Youth Academy as a staff nurse before I was a school nurse, and I had a brief stint in the hospital. So I've been working as a nurse since 1996, graduated from UAA, love that program, keep that program going, and it has expanded now to other venues as well. I was aware of the community health program when I was in UAA as a student. A friend of mine was helping do training out in Bethel. And for the school nurses, I think this is an extremely important program, and we endorse it wholeheartedly. In those tiny villages that can't afford necessarily or don't have the capacity to have an actual professional school nurse on duty, the community health aides perform many of the functions of a school nurse, in screening, in immunization compliance, and in injury and illness care that rises above the Band-Aid level. So I think that they're very important performing the duties that we perform in the larger districts. This doesn't mean that having a professional school nurse surveilling or doing occasional visits wouldn't be a good idea, and I would love to work with Chair McCormick on trying to make that more possible, even in the tiniest villages. But we wholeheartedly endorse having a day to appreciate those community health aides because, you know, sometimes they're unsung heroes. And as Chair McCormick pointed out yesterday to me as I visited him in his office, they're never off. These people come from their communities. So 10 o'clock at night, 2 a.m., somebody calls, they respond. And we school nurses learned about that during COVID because my cell phone would blow up any hour of the day. A worried person saying, do I need to test? Should I come in? Do I have to stay out? So I understand that more now, having gone through COVID, that these community health aides are just never off. And that's something very much worth appreciating. So thanks very much for hearing me.
Thank you very much for your testimony this morning, Ms. Bale. So I was expecting a great amount of people calling in and joining us this afternoon, but that's all we have for testimony, unfortunately. So I will now close public testimony for HB 78. Again, I assume there'd be testimony. Maybe we would have community health aides come in, but they're very busy jobs, so it's probably difficult for them to call in or even know that this has maybe been brought up. So just kind of in closing, I just really want to say that this is, for me, really a bill that I would say is a privilege to be able to bring forward. Living in a region, representing a region that has been serviced for community health aides all of my life, this is, I think, having an appreciation day for some of our health aides. It's just a small little act of appreciation that we can give for these folks who really sacrifice their lives to serve our communities. So with that, I would entertain a motion to move House Bill 78 from committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House Bill 78, Work Order 33-LS0492/alpha, as amended, from committee with individual recommendations and an attached zero fiscal notes.
Is there any objection?
I'll object. Just for discussion.
Okay.
This was a thank you.
To speak to your objection.
I would like to speak. I appreciate Chair McCormick for bringing this forward. I think that you spoke to it very well, and I appreciate the information that you brought to the committee about this important program. I think there's a lot of people in Alaska that maybe don't know about it all the time, and I think it's important to let folks know about who is doing what and how they go about their lives and what it looks like in places that maybe a lot of people haven't been to. So thank you for bringing this forward, and I'll withdraw my objection.
Vice Chair McCabe, sorry, he had his hand up first.
Thanks. Don't withdraw your objection.
I object still.
So I too would like to thank you, Chair McCormick. Turns out that most of the testifiers the last time were Shirtail relatives of my wife, including Rose Winkleman, who is a very revered community health aide, and a day to honor them, I think, is very important. It does raise awareness, and it raises awareness of some of the issues that we might help solve in the villages. The community health aides have just been out there slugging through it, and so I just wanted to say how much I appreciate it, and I think I'll be a yes vote on this.
Thank you, Vice Chair McCabe. Representative Hampshire.
Thank you, Chair McCormick. I just wanted to, talk about my mom, who was not a village health aide, but she was an RN her entire life, and she loved every job she had as an RN. She loved what she did. But the job that I think meant the most to my mom, and that she talked about the most, and that she loved the most, and it was the end of her career, was with YKHC training village health aides. And so the impact went both ways. I think her impact to them, empowering them to do the incredible work that they do in our small communities, was valuable. But what they gave back to her was incalculable. So it's an incredible program with incredible reach and personal for me a little bit. So thank you for bringing this, and happy to honor these people.
Would anyone else like to speak to Representative Ruffridge's objection? No? All right. Representative Ruffridge?
I'll withdraw my objection.
Thank you very much. Seeing there's no further objection, House Bill 78 passes from committee. We will now go at an at ease while members sign the committee report. We're now back on the record. I just want to take the time really quickly again to thank Ms. Chaitlik-Sifsoff for presenting. Did a fantastic job. Thank you very much. Make me very proud. Nonetheless, next week, Tuesday, we will be hearing House Bill 84 on municipal property tax, public testimony for HB 61 regarding limitations on firearms and restrictions, and public testimony for HB 17 on contraceptives coverage. Next week, Thursday, there will be no scheduled House Community and Regional Affairs meeting. The time is 9:27 a.m. in this hearing of the House Community and Regional Affairs Committee is now adjourned. Please make sure, if you didn't, get a cupcake and wish me a happy birthday. Thank you very much.